Ohio's law banning gender-affirming care took effect this week, but how long will that last? This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll talk about the latest in the court case challenging the law. We'll also discuss the first week of recreational cannabis sales in Ohio, an effort to use some of the City of Cincinnati's railway sale money to provide property tax relief for city homeowners, and the work happening to create a new neighborhood near Covington's riverfront. We've got all that and more coming up, and here to get us started is Ohio Public Media State House Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Welcome back, Karen.
Hey, great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. We talked a lot last year about House Bill 68, this Ohio law related to transgender minors. Remind us what this law is designed to do.
Well, this law was intended to be a combination of two pieces of legislation, essentially. It bans minors from gender transition treatment. And then it also bans trans athletes from girls and women's sports. And that was the basis of the lawsuit that was filed by the families of two 12-year-old transgender girls, that this combination of these two pieces of legislation violates the state's single subject rule for legislation, so that it can only deal with one topic. And of course, the lawsuit also says that these girls, if House Bill 68 were to go into effect, would lose access or potentially lose access to critical medically necessary health care.
So that lawsuit was filed earlier this year, and this week a Franklin County judge upheld the bans after he had put the law on hold for several months. Tell us how the judge explained his ruling there.
Well, it's very interesting to read the ruling, because certainly there was a lot of testimony in the trial. It was a 5-day trial, a lot of testimony that got very emotional from the families of the girls. And there were some testimony presented by the state that was obviously opposing that viewpoint. But the judge ruled that the law did not violate the single subject rule, nor did it violate Ohio's constitutional amendment on healthcare freedom, as well as two other federal provisions. But one of the things I think is interesting is to read his ruling on the single subject rule specifically. He said, while it may look like that there's disunity between these two ideas, the law relates to parental rights with respect to transgender kids, and also trans girls and women's access to interscholastic sports. And so he wrote, quote, "The law compels this court to conclude that the act contains a common purpose or relationship, namely the General Assembly's regulation of transgender individuals. No matter how abhorrent that may be to some, it is a legitimate subject for purposes of the single subject rule under the laws of the state of Ohio." So that's what the judge said there. And he said the remedy is for not to go to court and litigate it, but for people to vote on it. And that, I think, is an interesting conclusion there to note.
Well, and I want to note something that you noted in your coverage. Where do major medical associations stand on this question of gender-affirming care for trans youth?
Well, and that was part of the state's case, was that this is not settled science, that there are people who are saying publicly, doctors, other groups, that gender transition treatment for minors is risky or not an appropriate treatment. Now, major medical associations, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association, they've come out in support of gender transition treatment for minors. But then there are these other groups that no major medical group has come out saying that gender transition treatment for minors is risky. This is part of the reason why Governor Mike DeWine vetoed House Bill 68 when it first came before him, saying that he had talked to parents and people who were directly affected, and that they really convinced him that this treatment was medically necessary for their children. And of course, as soon as he issued his veto, Republican lawmakers then overrode it, and that's what started the lawsuit process.
And my understanding is the judge's ruling this week means the law is in effect now, but there's already been an appeal filed, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, this case was definitely going to go to the Ohio Supreme Court. I mean, it's a state law, and quite often, if there are concerns about state laws, they end up going before the Ohio Supreme Court to decide whether a law is constitutional or can be upheld. And so I don't think it's any surprise that this is moving forward. In fact, Attorney General Dave Yost, who defends these laws, as well as personally, I think, opposes House Bill 68, he said that he was pleased that this is moving forward because there will be real definitive action on this. He said, though, that he thinks it's important that there is an evidentiary record now established that this is not settled science, and that could be used potentially in other states. So this could be something that other states potentially look into. But yeah, this is going to the Ohio Supreme Court. It's going to the 10th District Court of Appeals first.
Well, I want to move along. You also spent time this week with Bernie Moreno, the Republican candidate for Ohio's U.S. Senate seat. Tell us about his bus tour.
Yeah, he kicked off a bus tour in Chillicothe this week, and he was visiting mostly smaller towns and kind of rural areas, though he did hit a couple of cities. He was in Medina, and I think he went to Dayton. He ended up, he's going to end up the tour tomorrow in Lucas County near Toledo. So he did try to do some bipartisan coverage here. But this is the first time that we've really seen him out heavily campaigning. And he's got a few hills to overcome in the sense that he's behind incumbent Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown in fundraising and also in name recognition. And so that's being reflected in current polls. He says he's, this is part of his plan to, as he put it, quote, open a can of whoop ass on the senator. And this is, he wanted to introduce himself to people in these communities. The Ohio Democratic Party kind of followed him around this whole week and had protesters at all of these events, really drawing attention to a payout that he made to former workers who had sued him for wage theft. And that's just one of several issues that Democrats disagree with Bernie Moreno on. I mean, certainly reproductive rights and some of these other things.
How did Moreno respond to those protesters and those criticism about his business practices?
Well, in the first stop, I can't speak to what he did later on in the week, but in the first stop, he went over to the protesters and shook their hands and got into a little bit of a discussion with one of the protesters. I mean, it's interesting visuals to see this, but certainly nobody was changing any minds with this. Obviously, the protesters there to draw attention to issues that they think are important that people might not see. And of course, Moreno's there again to build up his name recognition and talk about the issues he thinks are important.
And what are the big issues that he's talking about with voters? What does he want to draw attention to in his campaign?
Well, certainly he talks about immigration. He talks about inflation. He talks about instability across the globe. But he's talking primarily to people who are already on board with former President Trump. I mean, his tour bus features big images of both him and former President Trump. He talks about being Trump endorsed, and certainly the people who come out to see him quite often are strongly supportive of Trump. In fact, I met one woman who actually had two tattoos. She had a tattoo on her arm and a tattoo on her shoulder. The one on her shoulder identified her as somebody who attended the events on January 6, 2021, that started as a rally and ended up as an attack on the U.S. Capitol.
And she's a big Trump supporter and Moreno supporter, from as I understand it from your story.
Yeah, and it was interesting to talk to her because I said, does Mr. Moreno really get your vote and really represent what you believe in terms of your support of Trump? And she said, well, he better, or else we're going to vote him out. So obviously there's a standard that Trump supporters are going to be holding Bernie Moreno to.
Yeah. You mentioned that he's running against incumbent Senator Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown, of course, one of the few Democrats in Ohio to hold statewide office. How tough is this race going to be for both of these men?
Well, Sherrod Brown has even said this is going to be the toughest reelection campaign of his career. And he's raised a lot of money. He spent a lot of money. Moreno had to spend money in the three-way primary that he won back in May. But Sherrod Brown has been out there spending money. He hasn't done a formal campaign bus tour kind of a thing, but he's been doing appearances. And one of the things I think is interesting, though, is that he will not be attending the Democratic National Convention coming up. He said he will be skipping this one. I think part of that may be related to the fact that Republicans really dominate in Ohio. And I don't know. I mean, certainly Sherrod Brown is a Democrat and talks about being a Democrat, but tying himself closely with the Democratic Party may not be his strategy at this moment.
Well, listening to political news can be stressful for lots of people. So let's change the subject and talk about recreational marijuana. Sales started at Ohio dispensaries this week, right? What was the picture out there?
Well, my State House News Bureau colleague Sarah Donaldson went out to Piqua in Western Ohio, where there was a dispensary opening up. 98 dispensaries were allowed to start selling this week on Tuesday. And it's important to remember that 9 months ago, voters approved legalized recreational marijuana, but it took this long for sales to actually begin. I mean, people could home grow, people could use in Ohio in December when issue two from last fall took effect, but they couldn't buy. And so there were these dual use licenses that were offered that medical dispensaries were able to get from the state that allowed them to sell both medical marijuana as well as recreational marijuana. And that's what happened on Tuesday, is that these dual licenses went live and these dispensaries could sell to non-medical adult using customers. And there was a little bit of sticker shock. These prices are a little bit higher than, I mean, than maybe people thought. But that potentially will come down over time. And Sarah also is reporting today that medical customers will still be prioritized, so they won't lose their access and they won't lose their product as recreational marijuana users join the market. One other thing I'd like to add is one of the people who cut the ribbon on one of the dispensaries to do this is Republican Representative Jamie Callender, who's a longtime advocate for legalized marijuana, but a Republican, and he cut the ribbon and was the first customer to buy up there in Northeast Ohio.
Oh, that is interesting. Well, and I know, as you mentioned, Sarah talked to customers there. They experienced some sticker shock. What did the owner of the dispensary have to say to her about those prices and how they might come down?
Well, and I think that is the question. At least at first, the idea was to preserve the access to the medical customers to make sure that they still had their product. But yeah, the prices should be going down. But a lot of folks who were buying potentially had already been buying in other states where prices have been lower. And so that's part of where their comparison came from. The idea, though, is that as this market gets moving and growing and building, there will be drops in prices. At least that's what the hope of both store owners, I guess, as well as certainly customers.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Thank you so much for your time today, Karen.
Great to talk to you.
Up next, we'll hear about an effort to use some of the money from the sale of Cincinnati Southern Railway to provide property tax relief for Cincinnati homeowners. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The voter-approved sale of Cincinnati Southern Railway is supposed to generate millions of dollars a year to spend on the city's infrastructure needs. But a former state lawmaker thinks some of that money should be used to help taxpayers more directly. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about that plan is Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge. Welcome back, Sherry. It's great to have you here.
It's good to be here.
I want to talk to you about that plan for the railroad money, but I actually want to start with another story you had this week. You reported on this back and forth between the City of Cincinnati and Mercy Health. Start by telling us about the 2014 taxing incentive package that Mercy Health got to move its headquarters to Bond Hill.
So I started covering City Hall in 2014. This is my decade mark.
Happy, happy, happy City Hall anniversary.
And this is really one of the first big things that I covered. John Cranley was the mayor then, and he really was about development and business. And he and others put together a tax incentive deal for Mercy Health. It was called Catholic Health Partners then. It's been through some name changes since then to locate their headquarters in the city, like bring people in from all over Ohio, some other states, and build a headquarters building and locate here. And this was touted as transformative. Great for the city's bottom line with the earnings taxes. These are high-paying jobs from executives. These are the headquarter jobs. And then on top of that, catalytic to Bond Hill, that they were trying to develop some of these, old plazas, the old cinema that just had fallen into disrepair. And they're like, this one thing isn't the fix, but it'll bring other things. And so this was, I mean, when I look back now, I mean, there's like, this was a huge story. There was like 10, 20 stories in the archives about all of this.
Yeah. It had a
But
huge price tag too, didn't it? What the city offered.
$38 million, although there are higher ones out there.
Yeah.
But so the next thing that happens is the county reporter at the Inquirer goes on vacation. Can you even believe that?
Not fair.
And he's like, can you run over to commissioners today? I'm like, sure. Commissioners roll out a plan to sell some buildings and move employees, like Job and Family Services, like public-facing employees, into the Mercy Health Building. And it's like, but aren't people already working there? Nope. It all really kind of comes rolling out. They have 100 people left in the building. Mercy Health wants to be out by March of 2025. And, you know, what's going to happen to this big, beautiful, honestly, barely used building in Bond Hill? The county, there's been no votes or anything, but they're hoping that it can be part of their future plans. But it took us back to what happened to those tax incentives that are still in place. And it turns out behind the scenes, the city was, you know, kind of looking at things and had sent a default letter. And that process is kind of just getting underway.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, the city gives these big tax incentive packages, but then employers are supposed to do stuff in return. What was Mercy Health supposed to do in terms of job creation and that sort of thing in exchange for this $38 million tax incentive package?
More than 1,000 employees are supposed to be working out of this beautiful building. Payroll, I think it maybe changed twice, but at one point is $125 million a year. And then earnings tax will be paid on that. And now the tax incentive package allowed some of that to be repaid for a certain number of years. But they did not live up to their promise. When COVID hit, they went remote, as many, many places did. So that is a real thing. But they never came back.
Yeah.
And they told the city in 2021, we're never coming back.
And did the city respond then? Was the city kind of like, well, hey, if you're not coming back, here's what you need to do?
They did not. There's some tepid correspondence throughout the years. I did put it in some context. They let John Cranley know he's on his way out of office. He's term limited out. You know, there's going to be a new mayor. We're in the midst of a lot of, you know, federal corruption things going on at City Hall.
And a pandemic.
So it was a very chaotic time. And so you could kind of understand that they're not like, well, here's this day and you didn't live up to it in this 1 second. The city was, and they did say, giving a lot of grace to some of these companies. They don't want the companies to leave. They don't want to hurt them. You know, these things are good for everybody. You know, but at a certain point, it's 2024. They did say in 2021, they're never coming back. You know, they're not like, we're trying. We'll have a bigger payroll at some point. There's just not really any sort of, well, let's work on this together. Mm-hmm. And so the city is finally taking action. And a new mayor, new council, like just new city manager.
Sure. A lot of new. So you mentioned the city's taking action. Talk about what action the city is taking.
I mean, they sent a default notice and they're like, you owe the city $7 million. It is a short and to the point letter, $7 million. So, you know, that's probably the big sticker shock out there. The numbers do add up. They provided all kind of proof about what's been paid, what employees were in there, at what time. They do, you know, kind of have the records to back that up. For their part, though, Mercy Health is like, we're trying to talk to the city and they're not talking to us. They just sent this letter. We want to have a conversation. Mercy Health, you know, really does have a lot of talking points about helping Bond Hill, helping some businesses get started, you know, not just really operating in this bubble, still really caring about Bond Hill. And they want to have a conversation about that with the city. And then finally, last night, I just heard Wednesday night that there is a meeting scheduled for next week so they can have those conversations. Does seem like the council members, though, are interested in recouping the entire $7 million.
Yeah, because, well, and you mentioned in your reporting, this comes after another big job incentive package fell apart, and that was GE's headquarters at the banks. Give us a little background on that.
So now that was a huge tax incentive package. You can use the number $90 million in tax incentives or 102, which is what I like to use because that was my math. But, you know, a conventional talking point's 90, no matter what. It definitely was the biggest one at the time. And there are some pretty large ones now, but it still really stands out. GE was going to move its global headquarters to the banks. This, again, the same kind of talking points. We're going to fill this building with 1,800 employees. They're going to make the banks vibrant during the lunchtime hours for the restaurants. It's not just going to be game day. It's not just going to be residents at night. And it was really, you know, all these back office people's higher paying jobs. It was very exciting. The county and the city met together at the site and just so exciting and the joint vote. And that completely fell apart. But after the pandemic, GE pivoted. And they had a different take on what their business was going to look like and bring everyone to the Evendale campus. And they did engage with the city. Now, they owed $33.5 million. And they came to an agreement, whether people like this agreement or not. They together sat down and came up with this agreement and valued a lot of different things. They're still involved, is basically what the GE tax incentive settlement breaks down to. We're still going to give to Arts Wave. Just because we're in Evendale doesn't mean we're not here. We're still going to give to community projects. They gave $250,000 to the port to kind of start the planning for these last parcels on the banks. So there's a lot of things in the settlement. Not necessarily we're giving you a check for $33 million. Now, the city could use that. I don't think I'm talking out of turn there. But that's not what it looked like. But it was a very, you know, behind closed doors, but later you do see the records, and that was, they came to an agreement. And I'm not sure that's where everybody is on the Mercy Health situation right now.
Yeah. Well, am I remembering correctly that GE promised to fill that bank's building with at least 800 jobs? They might not be GE jobs, but will help
that's
get
some people
in there.
That's part of the settlement. Yeah. And to me, it's something, but there's room for 2,000 employees in there. And so I do wonder, it's nice that I understand why they want them to fill the office with 800 people at least, but it's piecemealed out. So right now there's three companies there, and last month is kind of the last time I wrote about it. And there's 600 of the 800 they had promised, but really piecemealed out. And I'm not sure piecemealing out buildings in Cincinnati at the moment. I mean, I work in a building at 312 Plum. It's not full. 312 Elm, where I used to work, it's not full. All of these buildings are, Atrium 2 is having a lot of problems trying to piecemeal these. To me, it looks like if you had a building with 2,000 jobs, maybe you could find a global headquarters. Nobody asked me, though. but that was part of the settlement. So to at least try and get 800 people in there. I did talk to Jean-Francois at Taste of Belgium. He's the closest restaurant. He's very, you know, he's hurt because he signed a lease there with a lot of promises of 1,800 high-paying employees that are going to come eat in his restaurant. He's like, that's not true. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be interesting to kind of see what happens to that big, beautiful building that's just sitting down there at the banks.
Well, and these are two very different deals, obviously, but it seemed like the city had similar goals for both. I mean, what were city leaders hoping these deals would mean for the city?
Always catalytic, right? You bring the people and they'll bring more things. Those people might live at the banks. Those people would eat at the banks' restaurants and prop them up at times when they needed it that wasn't nighttime entertainment. And the same with Bond Hill. Their theory was that they would need somewhere to eat. It would bring restaurants. Maybe they would want to live there. If you look at MedPace is honestly the template for how these things should go. A lot of tax breaks there. And now the flip side of that's a lot of gentrification over in Madisonville. It's hurting people's taxes and generational residents. And so, like, I'm not saying it's perfect, but if you're looking at it through the lens of tax incentives, that's what was supposed to happen. MedPace came. Those employees work in the neighborhood, they eat in the neighborhood, then it has brought all of these like destination restaurants and, like, you know, the most fun new bar. And it's brought those things to that area of the city. And so those tax incentives worked in that prism.
Hmm. How do these failed deals relate to the city's financial future? I mean, the earnings tax is really important for the city, right?
Well, for me, that's where it's like, why am I writing about this right now? And, you know, it's a summer tax break, Sherry, please. But, you know, I keep hearing about, there was a very serious conversation about raising the earnings tax right out of the gate this year. They decided to wait, but the mayor is for it, suggesting it is going to happen next year. He is the leader over at City Hall. I mean, I could really see this happening.
Yeah,
the Futures Commission is like, the budget is dire. This is terrible. That we need all kind of money. Well, there is money sitting out there with companies in 2024. It's not the year after. It's not 6 months after the pandemic. And following up. And we heard some things like, you know what, we're going to crack down on EMS billing because there's money sitting out there and we're not collecting it. And then I mean, how much money is that? And they're like, we're going to crack down on reselling tickets. And, you know, these companies are going to have to pay. That's the law. You have to have a tax on resold tickets. Great. How much money is that? But when you look at these big tax incentives that aren't, you know, necessarily following the rules, it'll be interesting to watch how the city deals with all of them. The city manager's office is saying, you know, it took her. She's not been here that long. Everybody's kind of, things have settled down, and that they are really going to be taking a hard look at these. And so we'll kind of see how these all unfold.
Yeah. And you mentioned that Mercy Health is saying, hey, we want to talk with the city. We want to try to have some conversations.
They do. And they said they want to help Bond Hill.
Yeah.
In the same, very same sentence, they said, we want to talk to the city about what we can, about, you know, what this repayment looks like, but how we also can help Bond Hill. And I think Bond Hill probably will want to be hearing that.
How are Bond Hill community leaders reacting to this? I mean, what do they think about this whole Mercy Health thing?
They do feel duped. They feel like they were promised again and again, we're going to invest in your neighborhood. We're going to do things. We're going to bring all of these things. And they just don't pan out. And I think they just, they feel hurt and they feel like it's our turn. You know, they have generational residents who live there, a housing stock, people who live there. They want some place where they can go and work. They want these things they're seeing pop up in other neighborhoods. And this was supposed to do it for them. So they do feel a bit duped. There's going to be a community meeting. I'll be interested to hear from real residents. And Alicia Reese grew up there. Commissioner, Board of the President of the Board of the Commissioners, Alicia Reese. She had a lot to say about it. And she was very, she was like, she was talking to Mercy Health and she's very upset about how this all fell apart. And my editor was like, was Mercy Health in the room? Like when he was looking at all the quotes, I was like, no, they weren't there. She was just talking in general, but to them and very frustrated.
Yeah.
She said, Bond Hill has been, I don't know if I could say it now, Bond Hill has been through and back.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about an even bigger pot of money than these tax incentives we were just talking about. That's the $1.6 billion the city got for the sale of Cincinnati Southern Railway. Former State Representative Tom Brinkman has some ideas about what should happen to with at least some of that money. Tell us about his plan.
He does. I heard like a month ago, he's like, we need to repurpose. So it's $1.6 billion. It's already grown. Of course, you know how the market is, like the investments, it's going very well. And that money was put in, the railroad gets sold. That money gets put into a trust and it earns interest. And then that earned interest is twice what the city used to get from any sort of lease from the railroad. And it very specifically is supposed to go to repair, you know, long deferred current maintenance problems, of which there's $400 million. Anyone who's driven on city roads would be like, oh, yeah, that. And so the city, in a pretty close vote, city sells the railroad. They like this plan. There's a state law that says this money has to be used on current infrastructure, and the ballot language itself, I went back and looked it up. You think I would have it memorized, but no, I had to reread it. It says that it was to be used on current infrastructure. Well, he is putting forward about, he's like passing around petitions to get on the ballot to spend $600 million of that money, take it, the rest could be used for current infrastructure, and put it for property tax relief for the city portion of taxes. This isn't your library tax, your zoo levy, so people would still have taxes. But if you live in the city of Cincinnati and any of like the actual city passed money, $32 million a year spread out, they would get a portion of this $600 million, also gaining interest in this new fund that he would create. And so he says for 15 or 20 years, tax bills would be cut to help people, you know, stay in their homes and deal with this huge property tax increase we saw last year based on a lot of the state data and the reassessment. And so he is adamant. He does not have that long a time. He's got to collect 8,000, a little more, valid signatures. September 6th is the deadline to get on the ballot. So you got to game it out at least a week. You got to turn in the signatures, have them counted. It's got to go to council. They have to write the ordinance. They have to vote on it. So we need a little bit more time. Tick tock.
Yeah.
He said, I can do it. I've done this. He's done 11 initiatives. And that's true. He said they don't all pass, but they all get on the ballot. And he knows what he's doing. And so he said, I'm doing it. And it'll be interesting to see It's hard to imagine somebody looking at the ballot and being like, no, I don't want property tax relief. Like, I don't know. Like, that's kind of his theory, that he feels like if he gets it there, it'll pass.
Yeah.
Because if you just read the ballot language, then especially when you read the railroad ballot language, if you sell this, it's not new taxes. We're going to fix your roads and we're going to do all of these things. It certainly looked great in that ballot language that you were reading on when you walked into the election booth.
Yeah. So he's got basically less than a month to collect all these signatures. Then he's got this deadline, I think you said September 6th, to get it before council. If he collects enough valid signatures, does council have to put this on the ballot? Or do they have
to? They do, long as it's legal and they kind of already took a look at it. There's this whole process, show us the signature, the language on the petitions and like turn it in. That's how we know. It used to be prior to last year that people, you'd see last minute petition drives. But now you do have to tell the city under something former Councilwoman Liz Keating did. You have to like kind of file and let people know what you're doing.
Bit of a heads up.
Yes. And so that's how I got it. It was filed at the clerk's office. And it's like, Tom Brinkman was in City Hall. Why?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge. Thanks so much for your time today, Sher. You've been great.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we'll hear about crime trends in the city of Cincinnati. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The city of Cincinnati has experienced some tragic high-profile shootings this summer, but what are the trends with crime overall? We're going to talk about that now in this recorded interview with WVXU General Assignment and Long-Form Reporter Nick Swartzell. Welcome back, Nick.
Hi, Lucy. How's it going?
It's going okay. Thanks for being in the studio. It's always great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
So, as I mentioned, you know, there have been some high-profile shootings in the headlines over the summer, and summer's always a bad time for that sort of thing. But what is the city of Cincinnati seeing when it comes to shooting incidents overall?
Yeah, great question. So, Cincinnati Police, including Chief Teresa Thiege, gave an update to City Council's Public Safety and Governance Committee this week, and the general trend line is down, both for violent crime and for property crime. Which last year, I think violent crime was down a little bit, but property crime was up, if I'm remembering correctly. This year, both of those are down. But there are some nuances in there that are, I think, important to keep in mind.
Right. And you mentioned that it's down from last year, but the Cincinnati Police Department looks at three-year averages, too, to get a little bit broader look. Tell us what they said about that.
Yeah. Also, in general, in most subcategories, the three-year average is also down. But by less sometimes.
Okay.
So it depends on kind of crime we're talking about here.
Sure, yeah. How does the Cincinnati trends compare with other big cities around the country?
So in terms of this general trend downward in violent crime and property crime, according to some data analysts at CPD, that is also down at other cities. And so a lot of cities seem to be having a downward trend after a spike that happened during the pandemic. And if they haven't returned to the pre-pandemic levels, they're heading that direction.
I see. There are some exceptions in all this, including personal theft. Tell us about that and what Chief Thiege had to say about it.
Yeah, so this is one area where crime has gone up slightly, about 3% since this time last year. And personal theft is both like you park your car somewhere and someone breaks in and takes something, or and they gave this example of you have somebody staying at your house for a little while, or you have somebody come in for a little bit and they grab something, and there's other ways that personal theft can happen. Those are up. Some of that is theft from cars of firearms, which is a major concern for CPD and something that they're trying to figure out how to address. A lot of that is public awareness, like, hey, lock your car up if your gun's inside of it, or don't put your gun in your car, like those kind of things.
Yeah. Well, and I know the chief said, based on your reporting, this obviously to most of us doesn't seem as serious as shootings or violent crime. But if you're the victim of a personal theft, it feels very important to you.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, there are a lot of people out there who can relate to coming out and seeing your car window broken and your stuff gone, and not a fun experience, and not something that's to be taken lightly.
Right, exactly. So even though shootings are down, the ones that we're having are concentrated in a few neighborhoods. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so there have been kind of repeated incidents in neighborhoods like Over the Rhine, West End, downtown as well. And in addition to concentration that way, there are more sort of multiple victim shootings that are happening in those areas specifically. And police aren't exactly sure why that is. The concentration in certain neighborhoods, though, does align with this sort of philosophy that Cincinnati police have about how crime happens, which is there are hot spots. There are sort of like problem solving areas where you've got to figure out why a few people are causing so much disruption. And that's something that CPD has been sort of like, that's the lens they've been looking at crime through for a while now.
Yeah, and I imagine they must be focusing enforcement efforts in those areas too, and through that perspective.
Yeah, yeah. Police Chief Thiege said that about 4% of, like, I guess the area of Cincinnati is where most of these crimes are happening.
Oh, wow. Well, let's take our discussion with you across the Ohio River and talk about the Purple People Bridge. What happened this month to help stabilize the bridge?
So, as folks may know, the bridge has been closed since May because some sandstone fell from it. It's a pedestrian bridge and a cycling bridge. If you are a walker or a biker, you know this bridge is closed and you've heard from your friends about it. And so they needed about $125,000 just to stabilize it to make it safe for people to walk across immediately. The city of Newport, Newport City Commission, they approved about half of that. And then the sort of like tourism organization in Northern Kentucky, they approved the other half. So that's the $125,000 to get the bridge ready to go. Work will be done on that. They say around Labor Day by the time fall starts.
Mm. This bridge has become really popular. You mentioned if you're a walker or a cyclist, you know it. I know you're a cyclist and a walker. I am only a walker, but I love walking across that bridge. How many people use the bridge?
So it's at about 1 million a year, which is, you know, for a small bridge, pretty impressive number. That's a big increase from when the bridge first became a pedestrian bridge. And, you know, people like Newport City Manager Tom Frome say, we're headed toward 2 million. Like, he only sees that number going up, which makes sense. There's development going on both sides of the bridge that are bringing more people to live around it. So I can see how that, you know, could go up. But yeah, it's become very popular.
Yeah. Well, and I think you had in your story, that's that million people a year. That's a lot more than when the bridge first opened. What was early kind of pedestrian foot traffic on that bridge?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the exact number. I don't want to tell you the wrong number, but it was about 200,000 people a year when early days of its pedestrian life.
Ah, huge increase. Tell us a little bit more about the history of the bridge. You mentioned it's a pedestrian bridge, but it wasn't always.
Yeah, the bridge was originally built for railroads. I think it was completed in like 1872. They modernized it several times. They, you know, made it for automobile traffic, and it stayed that way until 2001 when it was finally closed to cars. And originally they were going to demolish it after that, but officials in Kentucky stepped in and said, hey, we want to save this. And it got reverted to ownership by a private nonprofit who maintains the bridge and has opened it as a pedestrian bridge since that time.
Yeah. What are the long-term needs of the bridge? You mentioned some sandstone had fallen. If you look under the bridge, which I'm a freak, I've done that. It's really kind of beautiful, this giant sandstone formation that holds up the span. What are the long-term needs for all that?
Yeah, so they need to do some more kind of long-term maintenance to keep that sandstone from crumbling more. There's some other structural issues on the bridge that aren't pressing, not going to like cause a collapse tomorrow or anything like that, but that need to be addressed. And the sort of mid-term need is about another $125,000 to get the bridge to where like these needs, this isn't going to happen again where it has to close. But on top of that, the sort of yearly maintenance that they're doing on the bridge right now is like pretty minimal. It's like what you bare minimum need to keep it, you know, going. And there needs to be more money dedicated to that, according to Newport officials.
Did anyone talk to you about where that money might come from? I mean, nobody's swimming in cash these days. No local governments that I know of. Are they kind of searching for other places to get that money?
That's the big question right now. I know one thing that came up in the Newport City Commission meeting, which I think is a fairly spicy topic, is where is the city of Cincinnati on this, right? Like, what are they doing to help keep this bridge open, which a lot of people in Cincinnati use? So that's one question. The other part of it is, you know, what do they want this bridge to be in the future? You know, there's a lot of talk from both tourism officials and city officials in Newport about, we want this to be like this signature kind of attraction. It already has like all these people coming to it. Why not make something bigger out of it? So I think that's a conversation too, that maybe it could be self-funding in some way, like a public-private partnership kind of thing.
And there have been some big ideas for actual development on the bridge, right?
Yeah, I think about a decade ago, there was a plan that was floated and kind of stayed out there for a while about putting maybe a hotel and some shops or a restaurant on the bridge, which to me at the time seemed really wild, but is not unprecedented. There's another bridge in Kansas City where they're doing exactly that right now. And I know some officials have alluded to that bridge as like, hey, we should do something similar. So that plan could come back around. You could see something like that again.
Here's a total curveball question. I don't know if you remember this, but remember there was that bridge climb? Was that on the Purple People Bridge? You remember that one? Dennis Spiegel, he's an amusement park guy. For a short, skinny minute, there were people who could pay to like climb the stairs and like walk across the bridge at the— do you remember that? That was years ago.
I do not remember that, but I would have been one of the people in line to do it. I've looked at that so many times, like, because it's gated off, you can't get to it, and I would never trespass or anything like that, but I would love to climb to the top of that bridge. So if they'd ever do that again, I would be down.
Okay, Nick would pay. There's another revenue stream opportunity.
You've got at least one customer.
Yeah. Well, speaking of big ideas, we were talking about the big ideas for this bridge. Let's talk about what's going on with Covington's riverfront. The city's looking to build a whole new neighborhood near the river. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm sure listeners have heard something about this already. This is right along the riverfront where the IRS building used to be. And the city of Covington told me, like, hey, we're trying to like distance ourselves from the fact there was an IRS building there. We're trying to like bring attention to this new thing we're building. But that kind of is a good way to orient yourself as to where this is. And so this is an enormous plot of land. And the city of Covington has really decided that, hey, we're going to make a neighborhood out of this. There's going to be a street grid. There's going to be, you know, residential. There's going to be retail. They've got commitments to move NKU's law school there. There's going to be a branch of UK's medical school there. There's a lot of stuff coming. It's some townhomes that Dries is building, and then some apartments as well. But there's also still a lot of empty land. And recently they've put out some requests for proposals, the city has, to see what else they can get there.
You mentioned this street grid. This is kind of a back to the future sort of thing, right? Because wasn't there a street grid there years ago before this IRS, this sprawling IRS processing center was built? I mean, this is kind of going back to what Covington was years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is something I looked into for a series of stories about the Brent Spence Bridge sort of area. And if you want to go on WVXU's website, you can find that story about the history of this particular plot. There was a dense, like densely populated, vibrant community there. And I talked to one person who lived in the area and did some research on some of the people that had to leave as well. And this is a return to that feel. And I think city officials have been pretty explicit about that. Like, we really want to return it to part of the street grid, this human scale neighborhood.
Yeah. You mentioned these requests for proposals that have gone out to kind of fill in some more of the blanks. I know this can get wonky for people who aren't into reading RFPs and RFQs and all the RFs that come out of local governments, but talk to us a little bit about those, the most recent ones, and what the city is really looking for.
Yeah, so there are three different RFPs out right now. They have different due dates. One is for what they're calling Block K, and that really has no relevance. So I don't even know why I mentioned why it's called Block K. But if you see a diagram, Block K is where they're trying to put a headquarters hotel to complement the convention center, and they're going to try to expand the convention center too. So that one, they have a pretty defined idea of what they want there. There's another one where they really would like a large parking structure that has residential and commercial space wrapped around it. So it, you know, doesn't just look like a parking garage and also lets people live in it and, you know, like do business out of it. And so those requests, the one I just mentioned is due in August, at the end of August. So that one's coming up. And then the convention center hotel one is due in October, at the end of October. Need a lot, I guess, a little more time to put that kind of thing together. Then this one is the one that's really interesting to me. The third RFP is the one that they're really going all in on about, like, this is going to echo kind of the way Covington's, this part of Covington used to look. And so they've divided these up into smaller parcels so that developers, local developers, smaller developers can bid on some of these really small parcels, or they could team up and do a project on multiple parcels. And that they're looking for kind of more human scale, residential, maybe a little bit of retail. And in the middle of that, they want to put, they want to expand Russell Street and put kind of a nice, like a park, like median in the middle, kind of like you see on Mainstrasse. And so that's going to be the most neighborhood feel, old school, historic feeling kind of part of the development.
Yeah. And it sounds like they're really focused on trying to get local developers for that piece of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the smaller parcel size. They want to make it sort of more bite sized for some of these smaller developers.
Yeah. What's the timeline for all this? This is such a huge project. It's a huge piece of land. I'm sure you bike around there. I walk by there all the time. I live in Covington. I mean, so it's a big chunk of property. What are they saying about when some of this could really start to happen?
Yeah, so I mentioned those due dates for the request for proposals, you know, over the next few months. So I think they're really trying to nail down who's going to do what, where. As they're doing that, they're putting in some of the public utilities, the grading of the land, because it, you know, wasn't all level, and it's going to have to meet the riverfront too. Like, there's all that kind of to figure out. That's happening now and should be done right around the end of the year. But I think to know more about when it's all going to be finished, we're going to have to see what these requests for proposals come in as and sort of what exactly is going to go in all these spots. So, you know, I think it's TBD.
Yeah. RFP TBD.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with WVXU General Assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you so much for your time today, Nick.
Always fun.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.